Exodus 18:1 through 18:27. The 20th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on January 12, 1997 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1997. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Exodus chapter 18. Okay, God was doing two things in this Exodus. He's beginning the process of doing two things, accomplishing two purposes. One was to make the Israelites a people, which they were not. They were an assembly of individuals, but they were not yet a people. And God put them through a series of experiences together. He ends up giving them the law, and as what we'll see today is he begins the process of providing them with an organization, something that every people that's a people must have. We will take note. The other thing that he wants to do is to make them his people, his possession. It says in Deuteronomy 4:20, when Moses was relating to the people of Israel, what God had been doing in their lives. He said, "But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace from Egypt to be a people for his own possession as today." So he needs to make them into a people and his people. Those are the two things. In chapter 18, Moses institutes a certain element of organization at the advice of his father-in-law, Jethro. Verses 1 through 7. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife, Zipporah, after he had sent her away. And her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, "The God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was camped at the Mount of God. Jethro was a priest among the Midianites. And if you will recall, that's the area to which Moses fled after he had killed an Egyptian, fled Egypt, and went quite a ways across the desert to the area of the Midianites. And it was there that he met the daughters of Jethro and ended up marrying one of those daughters, Zipporah. So Jethro is his father-in-law. He is now with the Israelites. They're traveling back through the desert, and they're coming to the area where, if you will recall, Moses, as a shepherd, herding his flocks and probably the flocks of Jethro too, had been spending time around the mountain of God, Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. And they are now, the people of Israel are approaching that area, and apparently Jethro is in that area. And he comes to meet with Moses, and he is bringing back to Moses his wife and his two sons. So apparently when Moses had decided to go back to Egypt, when God had called him back, when God had told him that the Pharaoh that had driven him, that he was afraid of, had died, and that no one was pursuing him any longer, and that it was time for Moses to go back to Egypt. Apparently, at that time, he left his wife and his two sons with Jethro, and Moses went alone. So now Jethro is returning his wife and two sons. And it points out here the names of the two sons. The first is Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." This son we've heard about already. This is the second time he's been mentioned. And I think that the name that he gave to this son indicates Moses' sense of not belonging. And I suspect that he not only did not belong among the Midianites and felt like a sojourner there, but I suspect that he felt like a sojourner among the Egyptians as well. But that was also a place that he didn't fit. That Moses' whole life up until that time had been, up until he was 80, was a time of not fitting anywhere. Not feeling like he belonged to a people. The other one was named Eleazar, for he said, "The God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh." Now it seems like there are two things that he could be talking about when this son was named. There could be two occasions he could have in mind. One could be when he initially left Egypt and fled to the land of the Midianites. That he could have named his son in honor of that event of escaping death at the hands of Pharaoh. The other possibility is that when he heard from God that Pharaoh had died and that no one was any longer pursuing him, that could have been the event that he was commemorating with this name. If that's the case, if you look back at Exodus 4, 24 and 20 through 26, let's look first at chapter 4, 19. It says, "Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, 'Go back to Egypt, for all those who were seeking your life are dead.'" So that was announced to him. Then we have, in verse 24, a few verses later, that strange event. It's just three verses, so I'll read it. "Now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, 'You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me.' So he let him alone. At that time, she said, 'You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision.'" Now the question at the time, earlier, the question that came to mind reading through this is, who is that son? Is it Gershom, who was born 40 years earlier? Or is it some other son? And if it's some other son, how old is this son that has not been circumcised? If it's the second son, and if the second son was named in honor of the fact that Pharaoh, who was seeking to kill Moses, was dead, then the event we have here is probably a description of the circumcision of a young son, one that was just born or recently born. In any case, there are two sons. Those two sons with the wife return to Moses. And Jethro comes, and he has heard of what happened with the Israelites in Egypt. Let me read on, verse 6. "And he sent word to Moses, 'I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her.' Then Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, 'Blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people.' Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. In verse 1 of this chapter, it had mentioned that Jethro had heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So word of these happenings has spread. It's not knowledge that is restricted to the Israelites and the Egyptians, but it has spread beyond the boundaries of Egypt. It has preceded the Israelites, and there are indications elsewhere in the text as we get further along that the peoples knew in advance of the Israelites' coming that God had been acting on their behalf and in advance of them. So Jethro knows of this before the Israelites even arrive. But Jethro wants to find out all the details. And so he talks to Moses, and Moses lays it out that Jethro has heard in part, but now Moses is here to tell him all of the facts, all of the details. And in hearing all of the details, Jethro is even more impressed with what has happened and with the power of God. And so Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel. And Jethro says, "Blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." So he proclaims his blessing on God, the God of the Israelites. This next verse, verse 11 is difficult. The Hebrew is difficult. It's hard to know how to translate the last half of the sentence. He says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed," and then this second part is what's hard to translate. But Umberto Casuto offers this translation, if I can find it. Yes. He translates this, "excelling in the very things to which they laid claim." I think that translation makes the most sense. What he's saying is, I know that God is the greatest of all the gods, greater than all the gods. Why? Because God met them on their own turf. And the very things that those gods were supposed to be most powerful, in those respects in which the gods of Egypt were thought to be most powerful, God overturned them. So the very things that the Egyptians looked to their gods to provide for them, to do for them, God showed that those gods were incapable of doing it. And that Yahweh is indeed the one that's in control of those forces, not the gods of Egypt. So for that reason, it's clear to Jethro that God is greater, Yahweh is greater than all the gods. So apparently Jethro has reached this point where he understands that Yahweh is the God. At least he's the preeminent God, if he hasn't come to understand that Yahweh is the only God. Together then, at Jethro's initiative, they offer sacrifices, burnt offering, and he shares a meal with Moses and the elders of Israel. This is an interesting contrast to what just preceded it in chapter 17. In chapter 17, we have a picture of the Amalekites, these marauders in the desert, who are snapping at the heels of the Israelites. Anybody who straggles behind, anyone who leaves the group, the Amalekites swoop in and pounce on. They are taking advantage of the Israelites, especially those who are weak. So in the desert, there are people who are out to get the Israelites. But on the other hand, the desert also has friends. And here we have Jethro as an example of someone who has come alongside the Israelites and identifies with them and acknowledges their God. Okay, verse 13. And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from morning until evening. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand about you from morning till evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor, and make known the statutes of God and his laws." And Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you are doing is not good." The situation seems to be this. The Israelites are numerous. There are a lot of them. And where you have a lot of people, there are bound to be disputes. There are bound to be arguments that cannot be worked out between the disputants, the people involved. That there needs to be a third party to step in to decide how this should be resolved. And so Moses is performing that task. He sets up shop in the morning. He sets up his court, and the people come to him. And Jethro is observing this. But what Jethro observes is he's there all day long, from morning until night. Now, it's not clear whether Moses does this every day or one day a week or what the arrangement is, but it's obvious that it takes an inordinate amount of time. Furthermore, the people have to stand there all day. They are not getting quick justice. And Jethro looks at that and he says, "That's not a good arrangement. That doesn't work well." So he has a suggestion. Verse 18, "You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk, and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. And you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. And let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. For if you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace." He's saying this is not a good arrangement for you, and it's not a good arrangement for the people as a whole. For you, it's not good because it'll wear you out. And for them, it's not good because they don't get quick adjudication. Things aren't resolved quickly. They have to stand and complain to one another in line, probably. So what is his advice? He says, what you need to do is teach them the law. Tell them what's right and wrong. Pass some wisdom along to them. The other thing you need to do is decentralize. There have to be other people who are involved in the judicial system. Select people. Select good people and have them make some of these determinations. It's not good for it to be all in your hands. And what kind of people does he need to select? He says, able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. It's honest people who care about what's true, what's right. Strange definition for a bureaucrat. So this is what Jethro suggests as a solution to this problem. And so we have here the first elements in the formation of some kind of organization of these people. Some way that they can operate on an ongoing basis. Verse 24, "So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel, and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And they judged the people at all times. The difficult dispute they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way into his own land. It says elsewhere that Moses was the humblest of men. It is difficult. I know this from reading history. It is difficult for a man with a lot of power to relinquish some of that power and hand that over to others. And yet Moses saw the wisdom in what Jethro had suggested, and he did hand some of that power over to others, people who were honest and interested in what is true and right. This is where I'm going to stop in marching through Exodus, at least for the time being. I'm going to continue looking in what follows in chapters 19 through, for the next 10 or 12 chapters, is a description of the law that God presented to the Israelites. And I do not know yet whether I can understand that law. And even if I can understand that law, I don't know yet whether it's teachable in this forum. So I'm not sure whether I'll proceed through that or not. So let me take just a couple minutes to summarize what I think that at least I have learned in the first 18 chapters of Exodus. The thing that has particularly been impressed upon me is that God has been in control of this whole process by which the Israelites have left Egypt. 40 years in advance of their departure from Egypt, God was already clearly at work setting the stage. He brought Moses into being, and he protected Moses. And he arranged for Moses to be raised in a situation in which he would learn the ways of the Egyptians, the wisdom of the Egyptians. He learned how to be a leader. So God put him through this experience through which he learned a great deal that would come in handy later on, that would make him capable of doing what God wanted him to do. Then, at the age of 40, God set up a situation in which Moses had to leave Egypt. And Moses looks at what's going on and he says, man, God blew it. I mean, either God blew it or he's thinking, I'm not the man for the job. God has decided I'm not the man for the job. That something haywire happened. And Moses was driven out of Egypt into the desert of all places. I mean, what can happen in the desert? Things can happen in Egypt, but in the desert, things can't happen. At least it seems that way. And yet in the desert, Moses learned another very important lesson. Probably as important as what he learned in Egypt, and that was humility. So for 40 years, God pounded Moses to the point where when God comes back to him after those 40 years, and God says, you're the man for the job, Moses says, I don't think so. And God has to persuade him to do what God had been shaping him to do all along for all 80 years. And Moses goes back and says, here I am, we're leaving. And he goes to Pharaoh and he says, Pharaoh, we're out of here. And Pharaoh says, I don't think so. Not only does Pharaoh say, I don't think so, but the very people that Moses went back to lead out of Egypt, to lead out of suffering and pain, end up immediately experiencing more pain and suffering as a result of that. And Moses is going, this isn't right. Something's screwy here. And then God begins to move. God says, there's nothing's out of hand. This is all what I had planned from the beginning. I have hardened Pharaoh's heart, and I've hardened it for a purpose. And that purpose is so that I can show you who I am. I can show you all of my power. We're going to have this little contest. We're going to put the gods of Egypt here and me here, and we're going to see who wins. We're going to see where the real power is. We're going to see who's really in control of things. And God displays his power. And through those displays of power, God compels Pharaoh to allow the Israelites to go. And they leave, and they're headed out towards Promised Land. And God says, turn left. Go camp with your backs to the Red Sea. Looks like a good place to camp. So it looks like they're taking all these strange jogs in the desert. And Pharaoh looks at it and he says, they're lost. This is my chance. I can go get my lost people, my lost workforce. I can get them back. Those plagues weren't all that bad. It was just luck. So he goes chasing after them. And the army is bearing down on the Israelites. And the people come to Moses and they say, this is insane. Here you save us so that we can be massacred. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And Moses turns to God and says, what do I do here? You said you're going to deliver us, but I don't see it. And God says, that's easy. Open up the Red Sea. And the sea parts, and they go through on dry land, and the water crashes in on the Egyptians. So they've been saved. They celebrate on the other shore. But then they go 3 days without water. Had God saved them? Or had God just temporarily kept them alive so that they could die of thirst? They come on water finally. Yay, water! But they can't drink it. Is God cruel? 3 days of no water, the first water they see, and they can't drink it. But God says, take a tree, throw it in the water, and it's made sweet, and they can drink it. They march further. There's no food. Things are out of control again. God's brought us out here. He's done all these things to get it this far, and now he's leaving us to die. God says, no problem. Food will drop out of heaven. You'll have meat and you'll have bread. And they had meat and they had bread. There are these Amalekites on their heels, wiping out all the stragglers. Is that what God brought the Israelites into the desert for? So that everybody, as they got weary and straggled behind, that they would be killed by these tribesmen? God sends the Israelites out against them. And as long as Moses has his arms raised to God, the Israelites prevail. And with the help of Aaron and Hur, he is able to keep his arm. They hold his arms up so that Israel will prevail. And they defeat the Amalekites. At every turn, as they look at their day, which is what we do, is we look just at our day. As they look at their day, it looks like things are out of control. It looks like God is not there. It's only when you step back and look at the whole sweep of things that God is there throughout. There are always these twists and turns that don't seem like they are in the plan. They seem sometimes cruel. No care. Lack of love. God's not there. God isn't concerned. It seems that way. And yet, as we see in the whole scope of Exodus, all of those little pieces that look like cruel twists and turns in the path, they all have a purpose. It's just hard when you're focusing on the day to see the purpose for those little twists and turns that don't seem like they're on the path. And yet I think that that's exactly what God is teaching them, is that when you come to those twists and turns, just be patient. God will work it out. You have to trust Him. He's been faithful in the past. He's taken care of your needs. He will do so now. The greatest conflict comes when, on that one question, what is a need? We have a sense of what we need. And most of the twists and turns in our lives, and the lives of the Israelites, were with respect to those needs. Those things that they sensed that they needed, God wasn't providing. But God has a different definition of need. God has a different perspective on what we're all about and what needs to be accomplished in our lives. And some of those things that seem to us like they're really crucial, from God's perspective, there are more important things. The things that we look at and seem really crucial are things like food. If we don't have food, we die. From God's perspective, if we don't have righteousness, we die. So it's from His perspective then that He is taking care of our needs. His understanding of what we need doesn't correspond with our understanding of what we need. It's only to the extent that He has made us to understand what we really need that we can understand what He's doing. But oftentimes that escapes us. He's doing things that are very mysterious in our lives. He's working on our hearts, on our spirits. And we have to learn to trust Him. It may seem like He doesn't care about us when He doesn't meet the things that we think that we need. But in fact, He's working on something more significant. He's working on what He knows that we need. But we have to trust Him in that. We have to trust that He knows what we need and that He is working to provide that very thing, as only He knows how. I think what we see here in these first 18 chapters of Exodus is the kind of thing that I need to be reminded of on an almost daily basis. Because it is very common for me in my experience to run into times when I am forced to make bricks without straw, where my babies are killed, where I go without water, I go without food. And I need to be reminded that those things all serve a purpose. God's in there doing His thing. And He can be trusted. If I look back at my life, He's been very faithful to me. He really has. And I can only expect that He will continue to be so. And it is foolish of me to lose sight of what He's done and who He is, and to think that now He doesn't care about me or He's absent. These are tough lessons. These are lessons that we all forget. The Israelites forgot them. It's event after event that God is using to pound this into the people of Israel, and yet they'll forget, and we forget too. And these are things that we need to be reminded of. We need to remind ourselves of them as well as remind one another of them. God is indeed faithful. He does indeed love us, and He knows what He's doing. And He is busy doing His work. He's busy transforming us into the people that He wants us to be. Questions or comments? Margaret.
When C.S. Lewis lost his wife, Joy, and he wrote Grief Observed, the possibility that God was a cosmic sadist was very real to him. Mm-hmm. Why would God interrupt his perfectly happy, stable life with this exhilarating relationship and then just take it away. And I should go back and reread the book because I can't remember how he worked his way out of it, but it was a very real possibility to him that we were like rats in a cage and like God is the scientist, you know, setting us up for a fall. And what I remember of it was that it occurred to him that there was another interpretation, that there really, that wasn't the only possible interpretation, and why he thought this the other interpretation was more likely. I can't remember. But at the time that I read it, I thought, if C.S. Lewis only had that little slice of his life to look at, it would seem very, very realistic interpretation. Because he was perfectly happy before he met her, and he wouldn't have known the difference if he had never met her or never experienced that. I really like what you said about not only the Israelites being lessons for us to be able to see, to be able to use that input when we're thinking about questions like C.S. Lewis was, but also our own lives, watching how there are desert periods and thirsty periods and that kind of thing, but God seems to take care of us. Can you comment any more? The idea of God as a cosmic sadist, there's something about that that grabbed me. I know I'm not supposed to be enthralled with that idea, and 80% of me is convinced from stuff like looking at my own life and looking at what happened with the Israelites. But maybe there's a part of me to which feeling is not a good word, but compelling, perhaps because I am an evil person and I'm surrounded by evil people who are sadists, and it's since I've seen stuff like that and I've experienced myself being on the sadistic end of things, it's all too believable that there should be a being who was a sadist. Can you comment about that?
I'd recommend you go back and read C.S. Lewis. I think you'd be more helpful.
Completely get it. It seemed like it was a real leap. There's this other option, and wave your hands really quickly. I'm going to go for that option. I don't think he explained it very well, but I'll go back.
The thing that I keep coming back to is that the way the Bible describes our experience and what God is all about, what kind of God he is, what he wants to accomplish in our lives, that makes so much sense of my experience that I too have entertained for brief periods the sadist notion. I think anyone who has been in a situation where it seems like God has led them along in a certain direction so that their expectations towards something were heightened and then seemingly cut those off, one entertains that notion of God as a sadist. But every time in my life that's happened, with a little more perspective, I begin to see that there was good that came out of that that could not have happened otherwise. Tremendous good that came out of that. And then the sadist theory kind of fades when you start to see how it wasn't as sadistic as it appeared, just focusing on that one event all in isolation. God uses really strange means to accomplish his purposes. It's hard to anticipate him. And he can use means that seem, on the short term, through the microscope, they look absolutely contrary to the kind of God that he is. But when you pan back and see that little event in the larger context, you go, oh, sometimes. Sometimes you still can't see it. But you have to assume that if you could pan back further, then you could go, oh, that it would fit in. Yes.
Is perhaps part of this answered or explored by way of, I just finished reading this article in the last about pain and glory. This may be taking a look at our cultural belief that pain is bad. And saying, okay, maybe it's not bad. Maybe it's just unpleasant. And maybe unpleasant is necessarily bad.
Yeah, we live in a Disneyland. It's a strange culture that can't accept pain and suffering, when pain and suffering is 80% of experience. It's a strange culture. There's something wrong. Ron?
I have a more mundane question. As you were reading what Jethro was saying to Moses, I know this had never occurred to me before. I'm sure this is probably obvious, but he says, you be the people's, 19, you be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God, then teach them the statutes and the laws. Am I reading too much into that to see that it sort of sounds as if Moses is taking the disputes that come up to God, and that God is himself is sort of pronouncing on what ought to happen? The reason I'm raising that question is it sort of paints a picture that the law that God is about to give Moses is actually, in a lot of cases, case law that has arisen out of difficulties that Moses has brought God to the people. Is that right? Do you think that's what...
Well, that is what occurred to me when I was looking at this chapter, is much of the law as it is presented is in fact case law. It's in this situation, these were the circumstances, and this is what was decided. It isn't presented quite that clearly, but I think that's what we have there. So it's not comprehensive in that it's talking about using general principles throughout, but it's a lot of examples of how God's laws apply to specific situations. And it did occur to me that, for one thing, I was surprised it even talks about the statutes and the laws here, because they haven't been given yet. So it could be that the laws that were given actually are, to a large extent, a compilation of these rulings that God has led Moses to give over an extended period of time. And so then what we read in this next section of Exodus is just that, all that stuff pulled together, and then some general principles extracted out of that. Could be. Bill, did you have a...
Come on. Thinking about the role that pain plays in our lives and the idea of God being the sadist. I remember Alexander Solzhenitsyn at the end of his time in Russia, the first time, having escaped the camp still alive, was able finally to look back on his camp experiences and thank God for those.
God bless the prison camps.
He was a different person. And there are a lot of things in my life I would never have chosen and would have done anything to get out of, and I couldn't. And I'm convinced God has deepened me and matured me and given me better sight as a result of it. And I think what you were saying about God's agenda being the thing that he follows instead of ours is really the key to it. It's like a parent. I don't not love my kids because I don't love them according to their agenda. And the matter of trust being based on my understanding of God's nature and that he's God.
Just from what Bill said, it got me thinking about the way that my folks discipline me. I don't like all the ways they discipline me. but their discipline came at a time of either right or wrong, and it learned that I learned that right or wrong had consequences, and I'm glad for it now, but I didn't like it then.
God is disciplining us in that same way. You know, we're very complex beings, each one of us, and as a result, what's wrong with us is complex. And God is customizing a treatment plan for each one of us. And some of those treatment plans are awfully bizarre. But we have to trust that He knows what He's doing. Okay, one last question.
I find this a bit convoluted. That as Christians, we say this is God working in our lives with the pain that we are incurring. And yet, we point over and there are some vessels made for destruction. Is God doing the same thing in their life, expressing love through discipline, just sending them like to hell? See, at one... Understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. I don't know... I don't know how to answer that. Yes, what he's puzzled by is we talk about God in all of His purposes being loving with respect to believers. But can we say the same thing about what God does with respect to non-believers? Can we say that everything He does there is loving? Isn't that essentially what... Yeah. And I don't know how to think about that. It is intriguing that what God says in Romans is that God works all things together for good for those that love God and are called according to His purpose. The guarantee that all things are working out for our good applies to those who God has chosen, God has decided, I am going to transform that person. We don't have that same guarantee with respect to people who are not believers. How do we think about people who are not believers? Does God love them? I don't know. I suspect there's a sense in which we can say yes to that question, and I suspect there's a sense in which we can say no to that question, but I don't know how to describe those two senses. So I think I'm just going to have to claim ignorance.
I think it is safe to say God is good to them.
Yes.
And why does He grieve about their trust if He doesn't love them?
If we are going to be good to the people taking care of the children, we will have to end here. Thank you.